Hello and welcome back to Big Mouth, where we hover over pop culture and drown out everything like a giant Chinook helicopter, keeping you awake at night. You may well hear them in the course of the show. I'm Andrew Harrison, and as ever, I'm joined by Sean Pattenden, the Her Majesty the Queen, to my grovelling Jared Kushner. Hello, Sean. How are you?
Thanks very much. If Princess Margaret wasn't dead, though, I'd like to be Princess Margaret.
With a fag in one hand and a gin in the other. What do you think? Topical. What do you think of this band Kildren being banned from Glastonbury for having a song called Kill Tory Scum, then?
I thought that was the point of Glastonbury. It's where the renegades get together. What is it banning? You don't ban things at Glastonbury.
Well, they were supposed to play the very, very prominent Shangri-Hell International TV stage, which, if I know my Glastonbury, will be a small mound of cans in a field at the top. So it may have been oversold, yes. This one, you think?
However, they've got marvellous publicity from it, haven't they? And they can go on to sell out Wembley.
They certainly can.
Kill Tory Scum.
That's Kildren with Kill Tory Scum, available in Woolies. Apparently, they say Glastonbury buckled under the pressure of the right-wing media. He wants to be terrified of a two-piece noise band. I saw Sleaford Mods, infamous Kill Boris Johnson band Sleaford Mods, with the then Northern Ireland Secretary Theresa Villiers at Glastonbury, and she didn't go on to murder Boris Johnson, and she's got good reason to.
Well, absolutely. Free speech for all, ahem.
There we go. It's the lesson here that nobody actually listens to the lyrics of anything.
It's pop music. It's meant to be about something that you may approve of or disapprove of. I mean, come on, kids. You know, the copycat stuff.
Come on, kids.
We know.
The kids listening to Big Mouth. Yeah. We have two guests today. Who's our first guest,
Sean? Do. He's the bass player to the stars with a CV that includes Pink Floyd, Roxy Music, Bowie, Madonna, Jaco, and even very briefly, The Smiths, which is pretty incredible. He's a rock and roll raconteur of the First Order, notorious for his one-man stand-up comedy show and extremely funny book, My Bass and Other Animals. And he's just come off tour with Nick Mason's Saucerful of Secrets, where he plays the Floyd's early stuff, difficult, with actual drummer Mason and Gary Kemp of Verse Bandau Ballet and Vocal Chores. Gary Kemp. How does that work, Guy Pratt?
It works amazingly. Because, I mean, Gary's pretty much my best friend. We've worked together for years. We've actually written two musicals together. Because the funny thing is, underneath it, Gary and I are both basically just a pair of West End Wendy's. and the funny West thing, the thing about Gary is, I know Gary's been getting really annoyed because people keep saying to him, oh my God, you're so good at this. And he's getting really annoyed of people saying, well, what was I before? I mean, and I think the other thing that people don't bear in mind is that they people go, oh, Pink Floyd's Spandau Ballet. It's actually not that big a jump because they were both, you know, like all British music movements start with a band in a club. In London. You know, in 1967, it was Pink Floyd at the UFO Club. In 1979, it was Spandau Ballet at the Blitz. And Gary said there was an awful lot of people who came to the Blitz who were old UFO heads. Mm-hmm. So it was still part, they're part of the same culture, essentially. Yeah. But Gary is a massive prog head as well.
Really?
Massive prog head, yeah. That's what I actually find more shocking than anything, is his absolutely encyclopedic knowledge of prog rock.
So does he bring in vinyls that you've never seen before?
Well, he doesn't do things like... No, but he knows all these people. When we played in Cardiff, he had... he played... what's his name? Mickey Jones from Man's SG guitar, which was brought in by his son. I mean, he's so in on all this stuff.
If you told that to the kilted hordes at the Blitz, they would have burned it. They would have burned it at the stake, wouldn't they?
So does Gary Kemp do a good impression, or Sid Barrett-esque whimsy?
It's both of us singing. The singing, and so we kind of divvy it up. No, we don't. I mean, the thing is that Gary's got a slightly natural sort of... I mean, he's in London, he's got a slight, as am I, but he's got a slightly natural Bowie leaning. So for the Sid Barrett stuff, works fantastically. Yeah. And he actually does... We do things like Childhood's End, which he sings amazingly well. It must be said, he has... I always thought I'd be the more natural one for the Gilmore vocals and he'd be more natural for the others, but it doesn't actually work like that at all. And he's also... You know, he's an absolutely kind of Premier League showman. I mean, it's... Yeah. So, yeah, no, it couldn't work better.
I wish I hadn't missed it. Can you play again?
I will be playing again.
Yeah. Oh, wonderful.
Don't you worry.
Is this Nick Mason's wheeze to play smaller gigs where he can actually see the crowd and all these enormous aerodomes?
Well, no, a lot of it is the whole... I mean, the idea is so great, which is playing the early stuff, which no one plays. I mean, within 20 miles of here, there's going to be 20 bands tonight playing Dark Side of the Moon. Mm-hmm. Or stuff off Wish We Were Here or The Wall, you know. And the whole Whereas the thing with this is, like, you know, I've played in every possible incarnation apart from Roger. Although I did actually play with Roger once, though he doesn't know it. I did play with him once with David. But no one does the early stuff. Right. No one touched it. And this is the one thing that now Nick really, really owns this, you know. Yeah, and all drummers are in awe of Nick, especially from the early world, because he played in a way that no one else did. And what's great is, I mean, I've never played this stuff before. There's only three songs I've ever played before in the set. So it's like rediscovering this pop group that was at the nub of before it became so weighty and serious and important. You know,
that's the bit where I switched off. So I'd like the early stuff. Absolutely.
Yeah, and it's like that's the whole point. That's why we play theatres and everything, because it's like the rehumanising of Pink Floyd, if you will. Mm-hmm.
Very nice. There you go. Two Sids are better than one. Also joining us this week is a journalistic mainstay of Mojo magazine and Rolling Stone, a former music editor of Time Out New York, and a woman who has interviewed everybody from Katy Perry to Chevy Chase. She also teaches yoga and sings folk music in her floating collective Springfield. It's a hell of a town. Returning to the show, it's Sophie Harris. Hello, Sophie. How are you doing?
Hello. I'm doing really well, thanks.
How is the yoga scene these days?
Well, depends where you go for your yoga, right, doesn't it? You know, you can get your kind of gym bunnies hot yoga. You can get your spiritual vibes yoga.
Is there a sitting on the couch with a cup of tea and biscuits yoga?
Absolutely. I mean, there's restorative yoga, which is kind of lying down, propped up with cushions, maybe a little bit of Reiki.
Reiki? Okay.
Yeah. What? Maybe brushing a feather gently across your face.
Yeah, okay.
But the thing to remember is that all of it was invented by Gwyneth Paltrow.
Absolutely.
So what pop stars ought to be doing yoga? Morrissey, Kanye West, people who need to control their rage.
Oh, my God. Do you know what? Actually, I was at a lovely retreat centre a few years ago in New Jersey, and we were I think one of the new Kanye records had just dropped, and I had a long conversation with one of my yoga teachers about, you know what, we should really start a retreat centre for troubled pop stars. Mm. Just bring them here, look after them, let's move a bit, let's be out in nature for a bit. It's a good idea, right?
Stop them making records.
It'll never fly.
Well, I didn't. It's the ones who actually do yoga, or rather the ones who make sure they're photographed with a load of yoga stuff getting in and out of a car. It tends to be the ones you expect is Moby and Madonna and Sting and Britney Spears.
But the chap from Maroon 5.
And the chap from Maroon 5. Have you seen face yoga?
I mean, face yoga's just like your basic face exercises, right?
I sort of think about this.
It's kind of contorting
your face. It looked like gurning. It looked like what I was doing in the 90s. Yeah. Alternate should be the fittest people in the world.
Hence your lovely bone structure.
Absolutely. Well, yes. Hem, hem.
It's chiseled.
Chiseled. Yeah.
Exactly. That's enough yoga. Sean, what's on the show?
Funny you should ask. This week we'll be looking at the must-see indie movie of the moment, Olivia Wilde's Booksmart. It tells a story of best friends and straight-A students, Molly and Amy, who realise at the end of their high school career that they've wasted all the time they should have spent getting wasted like normal kids, and they have one night to put it right. What do we think of it? And commodity-sized movies change the game in Hollywood. And in sharp contrast, there's the new Liam Gallagher Fly on the Wall documentary, charting his downs as well as ups since the demise of Oasis. Where does it sit on the Spinal Tap scale, and do we need to beware of intimate documentaries that are actually put together by artists' record companies? Plus, we'll be rationalising our paperclip orders and strategising toner supply going forward with Office Politics, the new album from Divine Comedy. All this after a quick reminder from Andrew.
Are you backing Big Mouth on Patreon yet? Because you really should think about it. Help us to cover our studio costs by pledging £5 a month, the mere price of a pint, and a world of extras will be yours. Not only do Patreon supporters get the show a day early, as soon as we finish nipping and tucking it, not only do they get the failed extra bit just for Patreon backers, this week Sophie and Guy are going to stick around as we admit to our best and worst moments in the history of festivals, what with it being summer and all that, but also, as of next week, there's a special gift for our supporters. A special handcrafted artisan Big Mouth coffee mug, so you can parade your erudition around the workplace and or home environment. Everybody who's backed us for 6 months or more is going to get one, and new Patreon supporters on the £10 a month tier will get one after they've been with us for 3 months. Patreon people, keep an eye on your inbox for how to get yours. Everybody else, search Patreon Big Mouth to find out more. Right then, Booksmart is the directorial debut of Olivia Wilde of House and Rush fame. It takes a load of tropes from high school graduation movies and gives them a very modern and very ridiculous spin. And it sounds a bit like this. Warning, slightly sweary, so maybe headphones for this bit.
Good morning, winner. Take a deep breath. Visualize the mountain of your success and look down at everyone who's ever doubted you. Fuck those losers. Fuck them in their stupid fucking faces.
Hey. Oh, shit. Woo. Are we gonna go to school or?
Nope. What's 2 plus 2?
Isn't it crazy that it's the last day of school? Are you kidding me? go talk to her. She's got a really cute smile.
Amy, do you know how many girls are going to be up your vagina next year? Every time I come to visit you, you're going to be scissoring a different girl. Dude,
scissoring is not a thing.
Don't knock it until you've tried it. Don't knock it until you've tried it. Ow!
It's the last day.
We got you through high school.
I need to go over the end of the year budget numbers.
Can't we just graduate, head off to college? That should do it, right?
We will persist.
I can't hear you. I can't soundproof glass.
We have to go to a party tonight.
What?
Nobody knows that we are fun. We didn't party because we wanted to focus on school and get into good colleges.
And it worked.
But the irresponsible people who partied also got into those colleges.
I'm incredible at hand jobs, but I also got a 1560 on the SATs.
We haven't done anything. We haven't broken any rules.
Name one person whose life was so much better because they broke a couple of rules.
Picasso.
He broke art rules.
Rosa Parks.
Name another
Susan
one.
Susan B. Anthony.
God damn it.
Don't say we're having a date night.
Why? It's funny your parents think we're boning.
What you two have is special.
We are going to show each other how much we care about each other.
We'll probably just do a Korean face mask.
I don't need to know all the words.
Prepare to get bashed in a fun way, consensually bashed. Sophie Harris, you were once a teenage girl. Did this relate to the teenage girl within you? What did you think of Booksmart?
Yeah, I loved it. Wasn't quite sure at first because part of what makes it good and interesting is the girls are interesting and you can't quite figure out who they are and what they're going to be in the first opening moments. The other thing that I thought, oh, is this going to work? Is that it's so of its time. So technologically, like the kind of social media interfaces and stuff, it's like, oh, is this going to date badly because it's so much of its time? And also, it's can we relate our teenage years to these teenage years because it's so different because of social media, that kind of thing. But you can, because they are real and they are fully fleshed characters. And the plot line is so interesting, and the gags are good.
Yeah. Well, it's actually weirdly, it is an odyssey, isn't it? It's like we begin in the morning. The girls think they have nailed it. They've conquered the thing that is school. They're going to go to Yale. They haven't wasted, and Harvard and all this, they haven't wasted their time like doing, you know, beer pong and bong hits like all of their compatriots. And then they discover that all those kids have been doing beer pong and bong hits actually are also going to Harvard, and they're crushed. And they think, we've wasted our lives. We must have one night. And the one night journey takes them on a kind of a slice of society. You see, you know, the rich kid who really wants to buy friends and is failing to do that. You see the losers, the idiots, the jocks. It's quite well-moneyed area of America, isn't it? It's a sort of bit of Catalan.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the other thing that's always interesting is, like, the idea of being teenage in LA. And I remember going to actually interview Katy Perry at the beginning of her fame when she was still drafted in to do a Vans tour. And they were doing the Vans Warped Tours in car parks, basically. And, you know, if you did, like, a punk tour in a car park in Croydon or whatever, you can imagine what it would be here. But there, it's like these beautiful tanned kids and the sun setting and everything somehow really romantic, even though you're essentially in a car park.
Yeah.
You know, and so to that extent, their teenage years are a bit different to what our teenage years are going to be. But as you say, the odyssey is recognisable. Their friendship is so recognisable. So, for instance, they have a code word, which I'm not going to give away, but that's a bit
it
like...
It is a
okay,
cracking code word.
which means... You now have to do what I'm asking you to do. You're only going to have one shot every year at this code word, but then we have to be agreed. And the code word is so perfect.
Yes.
And so, like, that would be their code word. And that's the kind of, like, ridiculous thing that you do with your best friends is have some kind of on-running joke like that. So I love that. I also love that you were never quite sure where it was going to go.
Yeah.
And it never fell at the first fence of resolving something like, oh, look, this person gets this girl or guy, you know, or, oh, isn't friendship grand? Like, it keeps you kind of working to see where their friendship actually is going to go. My one sort of... No, it's not even really a reservation. But there's a sense of, hey, don't work too hard. It's good to go out partying. And actually, when I look back at being, you know, 15 or so, I remember we had a mate called Tom Jones, actually. Oh. Not the Tom Jones.
That's not unusual.
And we were saying, oh, Tom, are you going to come out this weekend? And he was like, no, actually, I'm going to revise for my GCSEs. And I remember thinking, and he was quite cool, and I remember thinking, oh, that's an option, is it? You can be cool and do work, really? Huh? You know, and because we were always out all the time. And And part
Where's
of me
Tom
just thinks,
now, though?
Actually,
Where's Tom now?
Pretty happy.
He's working. Yeah. He owns Google.
He's fine. So I think, I don't know, there is like a slight glorification of, let's get wasted.
But I like about it is how badly suited Molly and Amy are to let's get wasted. Trying to inhabit it and kind of fail. Sean, you also used to be a teenage girl, I understand.
Yes, indeed I did.
Did you relate to this in a major way?
Oh, dear. That's making me sound like a real geek. Yes. And the wonderful that they go out to get wasted in jumpsuits and berets. Things like that that aren't necessarily flagged up in the film. That is wonderful. And when you see that, that's their idea of what they're going to get. Only later do they change into sequence. That's not a spoiler.
Although I actually thought the berry in the jumpsuit was like Patty Hearst realness. Yeah. I thought they were absolutely excellent on that.
I thought it was really good. It doesn't flag up what other films would do. One of the main characters is a lesbian. She's been out for 2 years, but she's not kissed anyone. Things like that. And it's just part of the thing. It's a buddy movie. It's about friendship. And we're there to see whether their friendship lasts, this blowout. What's a little bit cinematic is they have a blowout before the graduation ceremony. Wouldn't have they had that in the evening afterwards? Mm-hmm. They're not, you know, they're all hung over with the hats on going, oh, God, that was a really good night. But, you know, it's cinema.
That enables the final amazing scene, doesn't it? You mentioned like the fact that Amy is a lesbian. And I really like the fact that at no point does the story go, and it's a very serious time in life, and we really need to have a very special movie where we discuss this.
Yeah,
and
exactly. And nobody it's not else, flagged.
Yeah, she's not like
else.
The special character. It's just one of the characters, character facets of one of the characters in the film. It's accepted as part of the world, and they just move on. Now, Guy, speaking on behalf of middle-aged white guys like me, what do you think?
Well, when I was a teenage girl, obviously. I loved it. There's all the stuff to do. I mean, as I look on contemporary society and all that stuff, I really liked, and a lot of the gags were good, and the art was really, really good. But it's just, this is where I get to be grumpy old man. It's just this thing with American coming of age movies generally. It's just the privilege. Everyone's going to Harvard. Everyone's going to Yale. The poor guy with no friends who's got a yacht and the Obama's caterer. I mean, come on. Yeah.
But it does make mock of all that, though, doesn't it?
And this goes back to Ferris Bueller. It's kind of I would have thought that surely there should be more for kids to relate to. This, you know, in an incredibly more polarised world.
But I think that is the American way of looking at things. But their soap operas, our soap operas, are about people with corner shops, miserable.
No, that's
lives.
Right. No, because Americans love to see rich people being unhappy. That's what they're dynasty.
Being married to an American, she went to see Booksmart separately from me. Absolutely loved it. You know, wasn't really sort of one foot in this kind of world. Found it really, really, really relatable. And we've talked about this a lot. You know, she says, why are your soaps so bloody miserable? Why are your soaps all shot in kind of dark colours and everybody's having a nervous breakdown? Mm. What America's actually like is huge success with kind of Riviera stroke dynasty style intrigue. It's fantasy. All Americans believe themselves to be one step away from being a millionaire. Mm-hmm. You know,
well, that's the old Steinbeck saying, isn't it? The only reason that socialism never took root in America is because all the poor people, the proletariat, they don't see themselves as an exploited proletariat, but as temporarily embarrassed millionaires.
Absolutely. Whereas here we do it the other way around, and well-off people sort of speak mockingly and pretend to be poor.
But I feel like there were also moments of self-awareness along the lines of, you know, we have one of our protagonists who's off to do her gap year, helping women make their own tampons in Botswana. Yeah. And it's like, oh, spot on. A couple of other things that I loved. The underwear. They're wearing normal underwear and they're not all like hot teenage girls with massive knockers. I really appreciated that. The other thing, funny bit worth waiting for at the end of the credits. Because I'm a geek, I like to stay for the whole... I like the end credits to go up. Yeah. And people mock me and say, what, do you think there's going to be bloopers at the end? And I'm like, there might be a cool thing at the end. And there is a cool thing at the end.
I've got the strong impression that there's far more good stuff they could get into this, that Olivia Wilde could get into this film than she was able to. It just felt like often people's debut movies are kind of tentative, like their debut albums, and often their debut movie or album is everything they've ever wanted to do in their entire life crammed in. And there are fantasy sequences, and there's some things that, you know, certain film critics have gone rather gauche, kind of overuse of technique-y things and too many angled shots and too many sort of strange framings. I don't care about that. I just was swept away by the absolute kind of bravura excitement with making this film at all.
Last thing, soundtrack. Great.
Yeah. Oh, I was...
Soundtrack,
yes,
absolutely
yes.
amazing.
That was very good.
Yeah. Now, there's a few moaners. Unfortunately, it hasn't done particularly well in America. Huh. It hasn't done particularly well. There's a few moaners who seem to have gloated, particularly on the political right, have gloated over the idea that this film about women and lesbians by this bloody woman hasn't done very well. Ha, 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 isn't that great? And I just, for a kickoff, I think anybody who's seen this film, you can't get find some joy in it, it has got some kind of a problem with their own outlook on life. But the idea that you would take, that you would gloat over a film like this, not immediately smashing the box office, seems to say quite a lot.
Oh, it's only a couple of people, Andrew. Turn off Twitter. That's what I would say. Those are just whispers and that will end. I think it will become
Russian
more
bots.
Of a... Yes. It's the Russian... You know that wall of mobiles you sometimes see on that GIF? It's them. Because it's going to go DVD streaming, word of mouth, all sorts of things, and I think it might have its own impetus. Also, why does a film have to succeed in capital letters?
Yes.
That's an American thing. Why does it have to break all box office records? Can't it do quietly well and people go on to do it? It's got an amazing cast, and I think there are three actors I really like in it. Beanie, who's Molly.
Beanie Feldstein,
yeah. Kathleen Dover, and Diana Silvers is amazing in it as the cool girl who then we see another side of her. I just thought it's the springboard for a lot of things to happen, and that's quite exciting to see.
You're absolutely right. I mean, without giving away any twists or reveals, very few of these characters turn out to be the cliche we'd expect from a John Hughes movie. Literally everybody has another side to them,
that's
and
true.
It's all really...
And a lot of non-actors were cast for this, and I think that shows, and I think it's fresh.
This is my favourite movie of the year so far, and it's a year when an Avengers film came out, so you know what I mean? So we heartily recommend it. I think people out there, go and see it quickly while you can, because it might not be in cinemas that much longer, but go, and then go again, I think.
Ooh, crikey. Praise indeed.
I say that, I would like to see it again. I would like, you know... I'd enjoy that.
Should we just stop recording and go and see it now? You've been listening to Big Mouth.
Bye. Moving on. We always ask guests to bring in a tune for you, the listener. This is their editor's recommendation. Guy Pratt, what have you got for us?
A Calf Born in Winter by Kruang Bin, which is a Thai greeting. I can't remember exactly what word it is. And they're a band. There's two piece there from the middle of nowhere in Texas. And they're just brilliant. And they're something I kind of appreciate them more in the way I'd appreciate, like, sort of dub or classical music, in that it's not really track specific. They're just a wonderful thing to have on. I love what they do. I just love their whole thing. There's a lot of Asian influence and a lot of sort of Latin stuff. They have their own radio station, which plays the most fantastic eclectic bit of music. And this girl, bass player, moves in a way which is just extraordinary. If I could do that...
I think it's a big reach, actually.
It's a big reach. My life would be very different.
You're a lovely looking guy, but I think it's a big step, a big reach.
Apparently, our Thai department say it's a word for flying engine or aeroplane.
That's right, aeroplane. Yes. Although someone said it was a greeting. But there seems to be
aeroplane.
Some...
Aeroplane!
No, but I did actually ask a friend of mine who lives in Thailand, and he said it was something quite weird. It was almost like combine harvester or something. agricultural nice. Machine.
It's a worse.
Those Thai combine harvesters.
Fair bit of Fleetwood Mac Albatross going on in here.
A lot of Albatross, yeah, a lot of Peter Green. Yes, definitely.
Okay,
that's
right.
One of the things I liked.
It's Kruang Bin or aeroplane or combine harvester with a calf born in winter.
Neil Hannon is the Divine Comedy, and in a near 30-year career, he's done Burt Bacharach-style romantic epics, fatalistic pictures of the modern world, produced by Nigel Godrich for extra lols, comic pop operas, political satire, concept albums about cricket, and My Lovely Horse, the Eurovision entry on Father Ted. His 12th album, Office Politics, goes into new territory, the wasteland of the modern workplace, retail parks, suburbia, and Friday night on ITV. What are we going to make of it? Here's a taster track. This is Norman and Norma.
Norman and Norma got married in Cromer, April 1983. It could have been warmer, but Norman and Norma were happy as they'd ever been. They flew to Mallorca and swam in the water. It felt just like having a bath. The pina coladas hit Norma hard and she fell into bed with a laugh.
The Divine Comedy. Guy, are you aware or a follower of the Divine Comedy?
I've certainly been aware of him for a long time, yeah. And he's very clever, yes. Very bright, and it's very, you know, and he's got that lovely, very witty Ray Davies school of, you know, of looking at stuff. And I thoroughly enjoyed this album, but Again, this is why I'd rather listen to stuff like Crying Bin now. I don't really like having to pay attention to songs. And it's kind of like once I've
you
got...
You should have been a music journalist. You would do that all the time.
Oh, don't. After the thing I went to last night, which I'll have a little rant about in a minute, it's brilliant. And it's one of those things. It's like cricket. I love everything about cricket. I love it's there, and I love that everyone loves it. Now, as long as they keep loving it, I just don't really have any interest in it myself. Mm. And I think the Divine Comedy are great. He's incredibly talented. I love it. He's got all sorts of classics knowledge and stuff, hasn't
yeah.
he? And long may he, you know, do his thing. But I'm not necessarily going to listen to it that much.
I mean, his world is kind of Cole Porter and Noel Coward and as I said earlier, Burt Bacharach, as well as indie pop. And he's very strong on humour, which isn't always for everyone. I mean, I really like it. I like witty songs.
I like witty songs, but the only problem is it's like with humour in anything is that once you've heard a joke, you've heard the joke.
Yeah, but then I think sometimes there is a...
This is why you always cut out the dialogue on live albums.
That's always my favourite bit. I mean, I thought that it's an incredibly varied sounding record. The title track sounds like, you know, Prince working at Wernham Hog paper sales in with Ricky Gervais, and the overarching themes are sort of frustrated lives and small worlds and thwarted love affairs, and it's all seen through the kind of prism of performance reviews of the world as human resources. Sophie, what did you think of it?
Kind of with Guy on this one, actually. Mm. I mean, one thing that struck me as well is I think there's like a fairly rich mini seam of office-based records and songs. So you have like Step Into My Office, Baby by Belle and Sebastian, yes. or Power Lunch by Gossip. And, you know, I kind of want a compilation tape of office-based
office rock
songs. Yeah, exactly. But along with that, when you get your kind of the proletariat kind of songs. Sometimes I feel a bit funny about pop stars singing about ha-ha, modern life and these little people called Norman and Norma. And like, not sure about that. There were some cracking moments on it, like the single Cue Jumper.
Yeah.
It's great. And I like it when he goes a bit glam and stompy. And I like the tunes. I'm always a little bit wary of a double album. And there's 16 tracks on this, and it's too long for me. Like, for an album to really, really be, to merit being a double album, it has to be extraordinary and exceptional. And I found this a little bit sprawly, and it didn't kind of hold my attention for long enough. But I also really think that Divine Comedy are one of those bands that people love them, or yeah. they're not that interested, which is more me, and not so much a statement of like whether or not he's good, because he's, you know, a brilliant songwriter, does what he does really well, just not really my thing.
Thought experiment. When Radiohead did OK Computer, and it was all about life in an office cubicle and the awfulness of it, everybody went, wow, musical genius, because it had no humorous vein running through it. Whereas to me, this, okay, they're very, very, very different bands in different kind of status and so forth. But for me, there's a warmth and a humour in this and a kind of a satirical side eye that both makes it more listenable but kind of robs it of the serious art statement aspects one requires to kind of, you know, get in the end of year list.
Or can I point out, I actually never knew that about OK Computer.
Well, it kind of alludes, like all Radiohead stuff, it kind of alludes without being directly about it. You know,
that's the key.
Yeah.
Maybe illusion where, you know, that's the whole, you know, like with great writing, with all writing and poetry, the whole thing is being able to paint your own, you know, paint your own canvas to an extent.
Mm. Sean, what did you think?
I expected to really, really hate it because I thought this is a novelty record and I've heard Neil Hannon's novelty stuff and I quite like the stuff that's not novelty, but please just don't do jokes. Please just leave the jokes out. I liked it more than I thought I would. There are some amazing lines in it. But again, I've decided that he's the Alan Ayckbourn of pop. It's this little Middle England world. It's the British Empire, isn't it? It's this idea of these mini despots overseeing, you know, the poor minions. Workers, minions, whatever, and doing what they like with them, which is a very old trope. We talk tropes in this show, don't we?
Yeah, this Terry and June world.
Yes, and there's words like typing pool and photocopier. And the things that's the 80s office, isn't it?
They don't
the typing
really exist
pool is the 60s. Office, yes. There's a wonderful line, though, and I will say it because it just made me laugh out loud, and I was in the street walking down. And it's about an office party, of course it is. Live for now, bugger the future. Thus spake Zara Brewster.
That is
she
great
put
line.
The snaps on her Facebook page and got sacked the following day. And it made me laugh. So in that sense, it's very, very witty, but there's too much about staplers and filing. Mm. And then you get quite a gorgeous love song and then it goes into staplers and filing again. Although there's some synth stuff, some counterculture synth stuff.
There's a lot of counterculture, yeah. But if you managed to kind of somehow clone and resurrect John Betjeman and that came out with Slim volume. Everyone would be, the clapping would be very soft but enthusiastic.
Yes,
I think there are some great lines in there. I mean, that see that PowerPoint presentation worthy of a BAFTA nomination tickled me. And I like the fact that, you know, he can take a line like "You'll never work in this town again," which is just a throwaway comedy line that we're all familiar with, and he actually makes it about industrial churn and people losing, not just losing their jobs, but entire industries going, and then places it alongside a corner. It sounds like a Tony Christie tune from 1965 or something like that.
There's a song called "Synthesizer Service Center Super Summer Sale."
Yes,
I've managed to say that, and I didn't think I would. And I think it's about him having a nervous breakdown. And where do we all go as old synthesizers when we break down? It's the service center. Can we be restored? And I enjoy that because it became very experimental. Infernal Machines is quite experimental. That's the bit I liked. It's the then sort of hopping up and down and doing puns.
It is actually.
You could stop hopping at this
stage. It's two records in one, isn't it?
Maybe.
It's basically two. It's the world of office misery, and it's Norman and Norma sort of rediscovering their love through, what is it, a medieval battle reenactment, which is quite funny. Yeah. And then there's the electronics, there's the sort of world of electronica. I particularly like the fact that the Synthesizer Service Center Super Summer Sale does.
Well done.
It has, it scans, it's got, you know, it's got its own meter to it. He's got a musicianly ear. He also does a very, very odd tune called "Philip and Steve's Furniture Removal Company."
Do you know what? I dug that. I did. Oh, at first I thought, this is a bit sort of grating and repetitive. And then at the end, it sort of becomes this kind of...
But it's about...
It becomes very beautiful.
It's a kind of vocal round. And he has this idea that Philip Glass and Steve Reich are going to start a furniture removal company. And what would their adverts
sound like? Go-kart Mozart. Novelty Rock, yes. They fuse, don't they?
Well, as a fan of go-kart Mozart, I really like that. But I also find that the kind of the poignancy and the yearning for the past, you know, Infernal Machines, it starts off sounding like a 1955 news broadcast with a kind of, you know, a fanfare for the news right now, and then plunges into this kind of roiling glam rock about how, you know, the amazingly modern insight that machines have destroyed everything. But I still find it quite persuasive alongside the oddness and the humour and the strangeness. As far as we know, he's never really had an office job.
Yes, I was wondering that, actually.
I was wondering about, because I've never worked in an office. So that was a great thing that Springsteen says in his show, that like he, you know, he wrote "Born to Run," but he actually lives 5 minutes from where he grew up, and all his songs about working 9 to 5. He's actually never had a 9 to 5 job. So all the people who actually tell us these stories are people who don't tend to not know anything about.
I bet Bruce Springsteen starts at 9 on the dot and clocks off at 5 because that's how he inhabits that thing.
What, 9 p.m.
Yeah, clock in. In the morning. Clocks in. Yeah. Hard. Something. I mean, there's a great deal of sort of stuff in here that is so, you know, we talk about the Terry and June world. It's the opposite of countercultural. It's Diary of a Nobody. It's Death of a Salesman. Mm. It's everyday ordinary people. In fact, it's almost a caricature of everyday ordinary people. But when the world is defined by Love Island and Kardashians and Instagram influencers and everything is, you know, bikinis and hot bods, isn't this the new counterculture? The new counterculture is a bright nylon suit and a pair of National Health specs in your cubicle. That's how to be an outsider.
Yeah, but you know what? Then I just think of Booksmart and I think, that's the counterculture. The counterculture is always going to be the youth, isn't it?
Yeah. You know? What about zero-hour contracts?
Dex's Midnight Runners tried a launch like that once, didn't they? Based on the office works of 1968.
Yes. The suits look. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Good luck.
Yeah, that flew, didn't it?
The office compilation is really coming together.
I reckon. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
It's a thing. I can absolutely see. I really enjoyed this record, but I can absolutely see why it's Marmite when you do get, you know, this weird stuff like Synthesizer Service Center next to a really lovely little song like "After the Lord's Mayor's Show," all about what do you do after your big moments in life. Not for everybody. But it's for me anyway, and that's what counts, so there we go. All right then, it's Sophie's turn to choose a tune for us. You brought in Sufjan Stevens with "Love Yourself."
I have, double A side with my whole heart. So this is a double A, what he has released for Pride Month, which is with a lot of the proceeds going to LGBT Q and homeless youth. I mean, that's kind of an interesting thing in and of itself, because Sufjan was always quite guarded about his sexuality, and why should you not be? But, you know, it was kind of speculated on in the past, because there would be kind of allusions to queerness in the songwriting, this kind of thing. But it was never, he was never kind of openly out, as it were. And then I think more recently, he's been clearer about that for whatever reason. Of course, he wrote the Oscar-nominated song for "Call Me By My Name."
Yeah.
And then you have a kind of a gesture like this, which is, you know, very openly about being queer, I guess. It's a great song. It's really uplifting. It's really anthemic. If you have PMT and you like Sufjan Stevens, maybe don't listen to it on public transport as I did this one. Your eyes are... No, it's just something in my eye. It's great. It's a bit... It's the sort of synth, the end of Sufjan rather than the melancholy ukulele end. But also, here's the thing... I really love a happy record. You know, when I was a kid, I was so much more emo. And like, I don't understand why this person's brought out this really happy record. It's really boring.
Yeah.
You know, and then as you get older and you fall in love and figure some stuff out, you're like, yay, this person's found love. Great. And it makes you feel happy. So I really enjoy it for that reason. I'm also going to slide in a mention here for my album of the year so far, which is by a guy called who goes by the name of Gerardo Negro, and he's on Asthmatic Kitty, which is Sufjan's record label.
Mm-hmm.
He has made an album called This Is How You Smile. It is so wonderful. You know when you go to your friend's house and they put some music on and you're talking and you're like, wait, what is this? Mm-hmm. This is amazing. It's that record. So, like, you can listen to it free on Spotify. Go listen to it. It's so beautiful. It's really warm. I think he's done collaborations. His name is Roberto Lang, and he's done stuff with Devendra Banhart, and he is Ecuadorian-American, so sometimes he'll be singing in Spanish. And his stuff's been described, I think, as cosmic folk, which may or may not make him sound interesting to you. But the songs are just, like, warm, really groovy, so listenable. Like, it's so good. Go and listen to it, and then shout at me if you don't like it. But that's a kind of another kind of in-love-sounding record.
In the meantime, here's Sufjan Stevens with Love Yourself. Now, if you like Big Mouth, you might enjoy another podcast that we produce, Be There with Dali Loudspeakers. It's a fortnightly celebration of the minds behind the music from the Danish manufacturers of super, super high-end speakers. The latest episode is out now, featuring guests Kate Hutchinson on the new London Jazz Explosion and Michael Hann on what it's like to hear his favourite album, R.E.M.'s Fables of the Reconstruction, through much better speakers than any buzz have ever been used to. Search Be There with Dali on your favourite podcast app and don't forget to subscribe. And here's a taster. This is Kate Hutchinson describing what is, for her, the greatest moment in pop.
Obviously, there were so many intros that I could have chosen. I've chosen instead the weird backwards bit in Missy Elliott's Work It.
Yes.
I must have been 15 when that track came out. And I don't think, number one, I'd heard a woman rap before. And secondly, she was doing it backwards. Or at least so I thought at the time.
My question to you is she doing it backwards because it's full of rude words and rude thoughts?
I don't think she's actually saying those words backwards. I think Tim Plan was just like, put your thing down, flip it and reverse it. And I think he was just ripping on that by playing that backwards. But at the time, I didn't know that. I just thought she was magic. Is it worth it? Let me work it. I put my thing down, flip it and reverse it. It's your primitive, it's when yet. It's your primitive, it's when yet. If you get a big, let me search it.
A bit of Be There with Dali for you there. Go to your favourite podcast app and search Be There with Dali to subscribe. Finally, there's a Liam Gallagher movie out, and it's out right now, released immediately to download, Light Lightning, which is funny because one of the directors is called Charlie Lightning. Rock docs are the medium du jour. In fact, you'd rather have a fly on the wall film than a new record from most artists, wouldn't you now? The movie, as it was, covers our kids' arc from the collapse of Oasis through the short and slightly tense life in BDI to his return as Liam Gallagher, solo pop person. But is it Ross? After the screaming stops. Is it Spinal Tap? Is it a promotional vehicle? Or what? Bohemian Rhapsody, it ain't. We'll find out after this taster. As you are, SP.
Listen to XS Manchester. It gives me great pleasure to welcome a man who sung on some of the most era-defining records, not just of the 90s, but of all time, in my opinion. And it is Liam Gallagher. Nice to see you again, fella. How are you?
New man, yeah. Good man. Feeling good.
30 years, can you believe that?
No, I can't, mate. Still buzzing, man. Still on that crusade just to not get suckered in by the dickheads.
I'm not doing this to be more famous. I'm fucking famous enough, you know what I mean? And I'm not doing it for the money. I joined the band because I love music. I know how fucking great I am and I know how shit I am, you know what I mean? Proud of fucking staying alive, man. Being here, man. Not becoming a fucking casualty. Not letting the bastards get you down, man. All the people who've written you off, who were sitting there for the last 10 years going, man, he's fucking going to be dead now. He's definitely going to blow his brains out. Going to have a drug overdose. They've got all them press headlines waiting, but I don't think it's going to happen, lads, you know what I mean? I think I'm going to stick it out.
Manchester vibes very much in the area, as it was the Liam Gallagher documentary. Guy Pratt wasn't able to see this because he's not rock and roll enough. But Sophie, Andrew, I'm getting evils from Guy. But Sophie, Andrew and I did.
I can still contribute
to this debate. Of course. Sophie, what were you expecting is my first question.
I mean, I got what I expected, really. But it was very diverting and very entertaining. And, you know, and he comes across as really sympathetic. But, of course, he does because, you know, it's his thing. I didn't expect to see him leading his healthy lifestyle and getting up at 5 a.m. to jog across the Golden Gate Bridge. And, and that was lovely. It was really nice to see him, you know, with his family, having discovered what actually makes him happy. You know, and sure, I'd love the acoustic Now I'm Happy record from him. So that was cool. I knew beforehand that Noel had forbidden the use of Oasis songs in it. Mm. And man, like, what? Really? Yeah. You really forbid? I mean, come on. And I kind of wonder about it. I feel like with your partner, you have a partner, one of the reasons is so that they can go, you know what, that's a bit lame. You know, you call each other out and stuff. I'm kind of surprised that she didn't say, you know what, Noel, maybe with this one, let it go. But it's weird. It's weird to watch it and see footage of Oasis and there not be any Oasis songs in it. And I think it really does take something significant away from the film because you need that sound with those visuals. And, you know, the new songs aren't as good to my ears as what Oasis were doing. But it's really entertaining. It's really well done. Sure, he's been steering it. But, what you do see... I liked watching him hiking in LA with all of his family. And, you know, it was cool. I liked it.
Yeah. Oasis are alluded to, aren't they? Is there less than meets the eye to the split, do you think? Is it just a little Barney they had and then suddenly they don't talk for 10 years?
Yeah, I mean it's the classic rock thing, though, isn't it? It's like, oh, two brothers in a band for however long, 10 years, who always had a fractious relationship, then eventually fell out. Sure, you know, I don't think it's like hugely surprising. And they're, you know, trying to have relationships and then, you know, Liam's marriage falling apart and this kind of thing. Oh, yeah, there you go. I think what was more interesting was his kind of growing self-awareness, interest in having enduring quality relationships, whether with a partner or with his own kids, recognition that he was, in his words, a shit husband, that stuff. Mm. You know, that's really interesting. I loved the bits where he goes home to his mum's house.
I was going to ask, what do you think of his mum?
Yeah. The mum's lovely, and yes. I love that she still lives in her own house and is pretty kind of realistic and faintly amused by the whole feud. They haven't seen each other for 10 years. It's kind of strange, but you know, and it's wonderful. You go back into their childhood bedroom, which has on a little sort of brass plaque on the door, Liam and Noel's bedroom.
Yes, as he points out, that wasn't there at the time.
Yeah. Oh, she said it was there.
No, she's obviously put it on for visiting relatives or something like that. I don't know. Maybe she makes a little cash on the side. That's the bedroom.
Little
to the toilet.
It's happened. Yeah.
Andrew. Liam, we see him leap into BDI. This is the first bit. We get BDI stage. We get it out the way swiftly. How did you feel that started the Liam story? And this is Liam you was this the Liam you expected?
Well, I was. I've only met him once, and I was surprised when I met him. But what good fun and how kind of friendly he was. I mean, admittedly, I was putting him on the cover of Q magazine at the time, so he was going to be nice.
He'd be on your side
but
for that, wouldn't he?
To be fair, in the past, he'd been very, very horrible to people who were in great positions of power in the music industry. Mm. So I don't, you know, clearly it's designed to present the most sympathetic side of Liam, which is the you know, the kind of capering, optimistic, bit of a div, but knows he's a bit of a div, doesn't care. You know, literally every scene ends with him saying, what the fuck was that about? What the fuck was that about? Golden Gate Bridge, what the fuck's that about? And you sort of slightly get swept along by his enthusiasm for it. BDI was clearly a bad idea. That was like, get right back on your horse at the moment when you shouldn't get back on your horse. And we see it just, you know, drags itself down to a pretty ignominious end. Clearly, this has been designed to give us a proper dramatic arc of rebirth, and we've seen Liam, you know, stumbling away and showing that actually he has got a bit of a good voice, and you know, the kind of his ideas for a chord change are all straight from the Beatles, but they're a pretty good set of chord changes to be repurposing for the 21st century. So it's very charming, it's very funny, and he comes across as knowing that he's daft. He comes across as much more committed than I expected, and musically better. I particularly like meeting his new partner Debbie, who seems to have her head really screwed
on.
I particularly like seeing what Bonehead looks like now. Bonehead now looks like some kind of like cosmic wanderer with his little tiny, with his you know, floral shirts and his little goatee. And I loved seeing Paul Gallagher, who now looks like Colonel Sanders.
Totally.
Who was actually had quite a few insightful things to say about the family.
Yeah.
Overall, though, I couldn't get away from the idea that Liam is still desperately, desperately trying to reach Noel on some level. Stop being horrible to me.
Yeah.
Why don't you love me?
Yeah, totally. Well, but also in terms of them wanting to be each other, it made me think of Bette and Joan. You know, of Bette Davis and Joan Crawford, and their whole thing
Bette Lynch, but you know, it all works. You know,
Bette Davis, like, yes, she's such a good actress, but she's not beautiful, you know, in that that was the sort of narrative. And Joan, she's so beautiful, but she's not a good actress. And of course, both were both, but they envied each other like mad for the thing they thought they didn't have, you know. And Liam wants to be respected as a proper songwriter, and Noel wants to be a rock star in the way that Noel wants to be.
But it has become, the reversal kind of is complete. I now think about them in exactly reverse terms to how I used to. It's like Liam is the one I feel affection for. I mean, he's funny, witty, like I said, he's grown the self-awareness, whereas, you know, and Noel's just become this incredibly grumpy old, you know, doesn't really...
He's the curmudgeon, isn't he?
The total curmudgeon.
At home and says no to everything.
You know, Noel can be very, very funny in interviews, and he has got interesting, fun things to say, but he does seem to be a bit of a tyrant. And you can kind of, you look at Liam with this sort of almost puppyish desperation, which he can't let himself show because he's a lad from Burnage.
He can't let himself
be vulnerable, but it clearly does hurt him quite a lot.
Talking of which, I've got to say, in Brighton, right, where I live, there's the most fantastic, it's obviously coincidence, but there's the most brilliant bit of retail trolling I've ever seen, which is in the lanes, there's a pretty green, right, big green,
right.
And literally right opposite is a branch of Oasis.
Have you brushed paths?
Noel I've met a few times, quite a few times, and but Liam, right, I've only met him twice. The one time I met him, which was right in their heyday, and it was at the Groucho Club, and I was drunk, he was drunk, and he, when he found out my name, right, and it was literally just 10 minutes of, you're a prat, you're a prat. I am Pratt. You're a president. Yes, I've heard it before.
That's the first time anybody's ever said that to you.
Yeah, I'm destroyed here. And it was, but it was literally 10 minutes.
So
not a great start.
But I think Liam comes from the school. I think it's quite a Northwest thing of, it's not funny until it's not really funny anymore. And then you keep going. And going, and then it's really funny when people have been wound up out of their minds.
Elements I liked about it is you don't see Liam without a coat throughout the whole 90 minutes. Absolutely. Yeah, he's there with the bloody cagoule on. And I thought, well, props to you. Even just for that, you are on
so
brand.
Hot.
You can really...
No, I remember, because I went to the main road gig and they were wearing these ridiculous, huge expedition weight parkas. And then I was at the party afterwards, the Holiday Inn. But it's the same park. It's like, you haven't even got your party parker. It's the same thing. That must be rank.
Oh, maybe underneath it, there's another coat and another coat and another coat. And actually, Liam's only like a stick,
like
really.
Like
sheep when you shave them.
But it's the opposite of the northwestern thing, of the northern thing, which is of never wearing a coat.
Manchester's coats at all times. It's the northeast.
It's Sunderland that you can't wear.
Sunderland and the northeast is shirts in the freezing cold, felt out. Manchester, it's coats, even if you're at the equator.
I can attest that Liam is a very fit person because I do see him jogging on the heath sometimes. Do you? I do see him around. He does jog
every day.
Does he
say, as you wear,
as he goes past him?
No, he just pretends not to notice anyone. Yeah,
so a couple of things about this. I think it's too long. You can
There's
tell.
A bit in the middle, the bit of flab where he just tours the world and you're thinking, we could get on with this,
It's a montage,
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the bit at the end where it's like, clear that, and now we need to have something about the new album because the record company is making it. So there's not a very interesting coda about making the new album.
I really liked his sons in it. I thought his sons were excellent. The family stuff was really good. And obviously, they keep saying he's a family man, because that obviously that attributes moral values to him now. Yeah. But he does seem to be, and he gets on with the sons. And there was something about that. That was the realist.
But we have to remember it was made by the record company.
I know, but that was real.
And I don't, I'm suspicious. I
mean, something ever sees him.
It is the age of movies like this, like, you know, Amy and Marley, you know, sort of telling the story of the artist, but by the record company. And I think we have to not reject them and be cynical about them, but at least be aware of the fact that this is not so much being made by a complete outsider, it's being made as part of a, you know, part
it's
of
a package.
Well, it's obviously all the interviews with the PR sitting next to them.
One quick note to bring it back to Booksmart, and one of the reasons that I loved watching it so much. There was a point where I was watching the Liam doc, and it's like, man, it's a man's world. Nary a woman in sight, apart from Debbie. Yeah. And just how used to it I am as a woman. Just like where you suddenly realise, this is a room full of dudes, and there's another room full of dudes, and all the people in this band are men. And so it's like, I bloody love watching movies like Booksmart or Miseducation of Cameron Post, where it's like, yay!
Also, the British gigs, all the audience were men. There were girls in the South American gigs.
Interesting.
By the way, it looked like it was 98% men.
I went to a festival in Buenos Aires that they played at, and I was up on the side of the stage. And one thing I remember is I remember thinking, fuck, I'm glad I'm not in this band, because literally all you could hear on stage, all the monitors and everything, was Liam. Yeah, that's it. It's just Liam. He has himself. This was before he got himself together.
Right.
And it's always, no, it's not me. I can't hear me. And it's like, for anyone else in that band, fucking nightmare. If you're the bass player, all you can hear was Liam. If you're the drummer, all you can hear is Liam. It's just Liam. I've never heard so much vocal on a stage.
That's fascinating.
Talking of like record company made things, I just want to tell you, I went to an event last night, which made me feel. I got invited to. It was there's the upcoming Prince album of originals, which is all is all the songs he wrote for other people, but his versions of them. And I was thinking, this is going to be great, fantastic. And there was some guy there who's doing the archive, who was actually could do a Q&A, right? And it was at Soho House in White City, which I it was the first time I've ever been there. I can't go there myself because it's dancing on the grave of Television Centre.
It's nice.
The ghost of Savile.
I know, but you're still dancing on the grave. And but I went to this and it turns out the guy they're doing the Q&A with is actually who's in charge of the archive, and obviously doing a great job and everything, but he was Prince's A&R man from 2014 to 2016. Not that interesting, really. And I wanted all the technical stuff on these songs and everything. It's like, well, no, he actually offered the Bangles two songs and he turned one down. Okay. And what it really was it was an absolutely unique opportunity just to hear a load of music biz types talk really loudly over all these songs that we'd never heard before. I had to leave after two songs. I was fuming. It was just the
maybe that's how they get you to buy it, Guy, by talking over it. You can buy it.
I'm ruining
it. No, but it's just it was I just thought, you know, I was thinking John Niven could write this beautifully, but everyone would get killed at the end of it.
I think we're going to be doing that record in a few weeks' time, so we'll discuss it properly.
Yes,
as and when it comes into our hands.
Certainly will.
The end of the show is looming into view, and that means closing time chatter. What will our guests be discussing over a supersonic gin and tonic with Liam down the water rats in King's Cross back in 1994? Sophie, what's your closing time chatter?
I did a weird thing.
Yeah? Hey, that's great. Thanks for telling.
I did a weird fun thing with my pals who now do an annual expedition to the tiny village of Thaxted for the Thaxted Morris Festival, which is a festival of Morris dancing. And they hired out a minibus for us all. And we got on our little minibus, get to the village. And so they have... All the pubs in the village have got kind of barbecue-y things and nice ales and da-da-da. And then you have Morris troops from all around the country and the world. So there's a Basque Morris-y
Morrissey dancing.
That was a sketch that Keith Allen did when he had his short-lived... Yeah, the Morrissey dancing final. Sorry.
Not far from it. So the Basque troop. You have a troop from Kentucky with their beards and everyone's doing the Morris dancing outside the pub.
Amazing.
And then you have a masked dance in the middle of the village. So all the troop, the dancers dancing together. And actually, I really liked a lot of the music. It's very Wicker Man. Mm, so you have, you know, you have the like snapping crocodile... head
punch
type thing.
Yeah. Mm.
And then at the very end, so it's probably about 10, 11 o'clock at night, and it's dark, and everything's all been very rompy, pompy, jolly. But it's dark now, and everyone is shushed, like silence, silence. And down the hill, you hear this very quiet little violin reel, melancholy, mysterious violin reel. And the little, there's a special troop of Morris men, and they have deer's masks, wooden deer masks, and great big antlers, and they're doing this very quiet, very creepy dance. Ooh. And one of them is an old man dressed as a widow, all in black. And then there's a little child there, and they just process doing their dance through the whole crowd. And here's the other really good thing about it, apart from the fact that it's totally like, goosebump-inducing, weird, amazing Wicker Man. It was mainly silent. There were obviously a few drunken idiots were haying in the background, but it was totally legit to shush people. Because I always feel bad for shushing or wanting to shush, but it's just like,
And their crops have never failed.
We need to do those photos, like, of us 1 year and then us looking sad. Yes.
So Morris dancing Black Ops.
So if you're looking for something to do this time next year... hit Thaxted Village.
Was there an hobby horse?
Not hobby horse, but those crocky
the
thingies
twacky,
are kind of hobby horse esque.
Fantastic.
I think this could catch on. I think there could be more. I'll host a local festival if any Morris dancers want to come my
Paul
way.
Paul from Orbital does Morris dancing.
Fabulous.
There you go.
Yeah, let's do this. Let's do this.
There you go.
Morris Fest.
Wow. Oh, well, we're talking about what we're doing this summer. I'm about to go off on tour.
Again,
yay!
Man.
Yay.
And it's going to be really, really nice because this American
tour
just
was
so grim. This is with, Nick Mason's Source Full of Secrets, who have been nominated for Event of the Year by Prog Magazine.
All right. Yeah.
This is the great thing. We're going to start getting nominated for Prog Awards. And that's why I love me and Gary being up for Prog Awards. It's the funniest thing in the world. It's a really nice tour. It's all various festivals, but not festivals. It's more like an Italian festival that goes on for 2 weeks and we're the thing that's happening that night.
Yeah.
And it was
like
the first place where we're encroaching, actually. We're encroaching in my old world where we're actually playing the amphitheatre in Nîmes, which I did play with David Gilmour. So I'm slowly cranking it up. So,
is it primarily European, or will you be doing...
It's just European.
Okay.
This is just European.
Have you got any British dates coming up?
No, we've done a roundhouse twice. We did the last little tour we did, which I think might have been my idea, which is where we actually did all the classic Floyd venues, did the Cambridge Corn Exchange.
Right, yeah.
Friars in Aylesbury, which I'd never played before, and they gave me an award and everything for being a Friars Warrior. I know, that was nice.
Ooh,
because Pink Floyd kept them in business. They did one gig for them in 1969, which apparently paid off their debts. And if it wasn't for that, there would be no Friars, there would have been no Ziggy Stardust premiere.
Amazing.
Fantastic.
So I think Source Full of Secrets should just appear unannounced in a field at Glastonbury at 4 o'clock in the morning. You should just do it, not tell anybody.
And
people would think they'd fall into a time hole.
That's true. We should call ourselves Kill Tory Scum.
Absolutely. Sean, what's your closing time chatter?
Well, I've been listening to Joe Wood's podcast recently, which is about... It's called Alien Nation. Get it?
Alien Nation,
which is about UFOs. And she gets famous people to talk about when they last spotted a UFO. So she said Sean Ryder, Jean-Michel Jarre, Dan Aykroyd, I haven't listened to that one, Brick Smith Start, I was listening to it this morning. And it's Joe Wood who believes...
Yes.
...who says, I once saw a UFO. And then she asks someone when they saw a UFO, and they tell you,
get out of town.
It's not bad. I think they need a few experts. I think they need some people to go, well, are you really sure? And were you on drugs?
It's a weather balloon.
Do you know, if they had an expert on this podcast, the podcast would fall apart. Like a
can I tell you physical thing that occurs? I sailed the Atlantic about 17 years ago, right? With Rick Wright, actually. And there was this one thing that struck me, which is that when you're in the middle of the ocean, you're nowhere, when Venus comes up, it comes up literally flashing blue, green, flashing blue, green. You're like, fuck, that's a UFO. And it's Venus. And so there's that whole thing of the CIA saying to people, no, you saw Venus. Believe me, a lot of the time, they did.
See, this is the podcast to counter that. But it's very, very good. I actually did see a UFO once.
Did
I was driving, so I was so... It was in Camden.
A UFO in Camden?
Yeah, it was perched on a building. It's really weird. Looks like a...
That was the MTV building, Sean.
I saw one. Joe, get me in. Well, I'm not necessarily a believer, but I am having a lot of fun listening to Sean Ryder going, well, I looked out the window and it was with my brother in there. Well, you know, I do believe in strange things. And they just go off on one.
I looked out the window,
and it's like listening to a pub conversation. It's where you just don't want to leave because you're so interested in listening to the people
in the
next table.
Did Sean see UFO in Glossop?
It was somewhere suitably glamorous. it's rather wonderful.
Let's say Glossop then.
Okay. So there you go.
Well, my closing time, Shatty, you'll be amazed to learn. It's the football and Liverpool FC's historic sixth European Championship. It was a terrible game. But special mention, and the reason I mentioned it on the podcast, is Kevin Sampson, author of a series of great Liverpool-based books featuring, you know, the story of the farm dressed up in very thinly veiled to stop himself getting sued, things like that. He prepared a banner for a group of fans, and it was a huge big red banner with a live bird in the middle, and it said, "Fate up against your will through the thick and thin." And I have a Bunnyman banner at the historical sixth European Champions League victory. I think what the young people say, what they'd say on Booksmart is, "It got me in the feels." Got me right in the feels.
Actually. Sorry, can I...
The feels of Anfield Road.
Talking of Anfield, because you know, with the Source for the Secrets, we play Fearless.
All right.
And we use the recording of the cops singing You'll Never Walk Alone. Ah. Right, we have to... So we play that every night. And someone sent us a picture of the... For the Justice for 96, they have a big flag and it says, "We climbed the hill in our own way," which is a direct quote from Fearless.
Fantastic.
So we are honouring the cops.
There are quite a lot of music quotes appear on banners at Liverpool games. And I went to see Morrissey once.
Have you written them all?
No, I haven't.
Yeah. Are they all yours?
They're not me. No, they're not.
But they were the first people to sing. Apparently, football fans didn't sing. They cheered and they waved rants.
Oh,
Liverpool invented singing.
We invented singing, We also invented comedy and football.
Yeah,
and
Britpop,
I went to see Morrissey at the Liverpool Philharmonic many years ago in the days when I used to go and see Morrissey. And there was a Liverpool banner up there with the then five European Cups on it and the slogan on it was "Ring Leaders of the Tormentors," which I thought was like a very straight pull from a Manchester artist and put on Liverpool. Anyway, football, you may have noticed Liverpool won the European Cup. Just remind me of that.
Liverpool won.
You can keep your gigs will tear you apart. No lays at the wheel.
Old news.
You can keep it all. The balance of the universe has been restored. And I'm going to be unbearable about it.
Yes, you are. Shut up, Andrew. That's the end of the show. Thanks to Guy Pratt and Sophie Harris for coming in. Sophie, what's your next exciting writing assignment?
I'm actually working on two pitches that I'm dead excited about. One of them is a book, one of them is a podcast, and I want to tell you about them, but I feel like I can't say it out loud on air because I don't want anyone to nick it because we're at the pilot stage.
Yeah, okay.
Very wise. I'm well going to talk about it once
kittens.
We've done
it's
it.
It's going to be kittens, isn't it?
It's going to be kittens, yoga, Kanye, UFOs.
Okay. Sophie and Guy are going to stay around for the extra bit, the highs and lows of festival life. In the meantime, thanks for listening from me, Andrew, and producer Sophie Black. As a reminder to go and see Booksmart right now, as fast as you can while it's still in cinemas, here's a track from the brilliant soundtrack by Dan the Automator. This is called One Night Left, and we'll see you next week.